Okay, so Bruce, could you introduce yourself and tell us why you're in Bristol?
My name is Bruce Kent, and I'm the Vice President of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament and a few other things as well.
Okay, can you just tell us about some of the other things you're also involved with nowadays?
Nowadays, I work with the Movement for the Abolition of War, which has got a wider remit than just C&D, and I'm very active in Pax Christi, which is a Catholic peace movement open to all people of faith. What else am I into? Oh, as a sideline, I'm concerned with prison reform, but that's another matter.
Okay, Movement for the Abolition of War sounds a bit idealistic. War's been with us for however many millennia. Isn't this really a bit of an unrealistic objective?
I think it's highly realistic, especially when you look at Europe, which within 100 years has changed so dramatically that Germany, France, and Britain can never fight again. America and Canada will never fight again. Norway and Sweden will never fight again. The areas, the dimensions of non-violent resolving of conflict gets bigger all the time.
Yes, but it's other parts of the world where there's a lot of conflict, particularly, in fact, many of the old British colonies, places like Sri Lanka, massive conflict and genocide going on.
I'm not saying there aren't difficulties. Of course, there are great difficulties, especially the selling of weapons all around the world. But the fact is that domestically, here in Bristol, you don't solve your problems by shooting each other on the whole. And in the world, I see no reason at all why in the world in large we can get to the situation where we don't solve problems by shooting each other.
Well, I mean, we've got conflicts between North and South Korea brewing, between China and Japan brewing, almost all parts of the world now, particularly because of the global economic problems, people seem to be picking up the gun rather than talking.
Well, it isn't very intelligent, isn't it? The economic problems are not going to be resolved by going to war. We spend now, as a globe, we spend $1.7 trillion a year on war, and the result is more instability than before. So I think that what we have to rethink is our whole approach to security, and it's not a military matter. It's a matter of living together in harmony and sharing what we've been given.
But abolishing war, you're not going to get very far with the military, or even with maybe people like the British Legion, ex-military, are you?
On the contrary, I think it's exactly the military, and military myself, who actually are converted, who don't want war. They're the ones who pay the price, and I think that exactly the military are the ones. Many of the generals are opposed to war, last resort only, and all that, quite opposed to the Iraq War. Now they say it's nonsense, and it was nonsense.
Well, it's always easy to say that after the event. You mentioned that you have some sort of military background. What's that?
Well, national service, my age, I'm now whatever I am, and I was called up in 1947, did 2 years, 1 year in Northern Ireland and another year with the Royal Tank Regiment. So thank God I never had to go anywhere and do anything nasty, but I was in the armed forces.
Can you just tell us what that was like for you as a youngster? Was it in your teenage years?
I was 18 when I went in. It was, to me, I'd been to a boarding school, and quite honestly, it wasn't all that different from a boarding school. You were stuck in a dormitory with a lot of blokes you never met before, and you had to obey strict discipline all around the place. I learnt a lot of interesting things. I was running around learning about wirelesses and gunnery and so on, so I learnt quite a few good trades. I think I learnt to ride a motorbike in the army too. To me, it was an extension of boarding school, but other people, of course, had much worse experiences.
But it's not like that anymore, is it? For a lot of youngsters entering the army, there are all sorts of active regions of the world, like Afghanistan, up until recently Iraq. They're pretty much straight in at the deep end. And of course, you know, in between when you left the army and now, we've had a massive conflict going on in Northern Ireland.
We have, which we resolved, despite these perhaps the cynicism that wars can't be ended. In fact, Northern Ireland, more or less, we've come to an end with it. Of course, the world has changed, but we did sign a document in 1945 that saying that we wanted to abolish the war globally. That's the United Nations Charter. And I think we've made a lot of progress in that direction. That there are problems is no question. Of course there are problems, but also the strong steps forward. We've got now, which no one believed possible, an International Criminal Court. We've got an international court that works. We've got something like a global police force. So we're moving, I think.
But what's the point in having an international criminal court if people like Tony Blair, who started an illegal war in Iraq, aren't there?
The glass that's half full is also half empty, or vice versa. The fact that we can't get Blair yet there is true, but nevertheless there are well-known criminals, Bosnia and elsewhere, who've appeared in the criminal court, and I think that's positive. I hope we'll reform the charter of the criminal court to include wars of aggression, and that would fish in future Blairs. It won't fish in a past Blair, that's that's over. You can't go back in criminality to legislate against it afterwards. But for the future, I think there is some hope.
But I mean, the International Criminal Court, it really doesn't have a lot of credibility all the time. It seems by some coincidence, the people who are being arranged there are NATO's enemies, largely. We don't have any war crimes that have been committed by NATO, for example, use of phosphorus weapons and other kinds of weapons in Iraq, which are supposed to be against international law. None of these people have appeared at the International Criminal Court and don't look likely to.
I can't disagree with you. The Criminal Court is not by any means a perfect institution, but it's there. And 100 years ago, no one would have believed it possible that you could actually have a Pinochet in this country terrified that he might be extradited to Spain. That's all part of the criminal legislation. And I think we've got to build on what we've got. Most people have not the slightest interest in international relations, international structures, or things like the criminal court. We need people with reform-minded ideas to come in and help change things.
Now, you've been involved in the anti-nuclear movement for decades. Can you tell us how you first got involved? What first piqued your interest?
I got interested, really, from a purely moral point of view. I met an old Catholic archbishop who said that if it's wicked to burn 100,000 people, it's wicked to intend to burn them under any circumstances. And I thought, well, he's right. You know, we wouldn't apply this to rape or burglary. And yet all the moralists were saying, oh, you can have them as long as you're never going to use them. Well, who could say you're not going to use them? So I came in on a moral position. But later on, I began to realize all the political dimensions and the stupid nationalism behind the whole business. That's why we've got nuclear weapons, because we think we're very important. But other countries, Iran, aren't important and they can't have them.
Well, I mean, many other countries do have. There's been a proliferation. There's also quite a lot of missing nuclear weapons around the world. I mean, the Americans have lost some, for example, dropped off of a bomber, which was having trouble in the Indian Ocean. Isn't it inevitable eventually that some of these weapons are going to be used by either a sort of safe Western country or one of these rogue states we keep hearing about?
Well, even worse, something that isn't a state at all. There's perfectly no reason why Al-Qaeda can't get hold of nuclear technology if they want to. And against a non-state, nuclear weapons have absolutely no significance. And that's the world we're moving into. But all this adds up to, let's get on with eliminating nuclear weapons. I think it was Tuesday of this week, we heard that a treaty was going to be signed about selling weapons abroad. Well, I think that's a positive sign. If we can get a treaty on selling weapons, why can't we get a treaty on the abolition of nuclear weapons? Quite possible.
Well, it surely isn't, because the countries that have got these weapons are very reluctant to give them up, particularly, say, for example, in the Middle East, where Israel's got the weapons and supposedly, anyway, Iran doesn't have them. They're hardly likely to give it up because it gives them the edge in geopolitics, doesn't it?
It doesn't give you anything except a fig leaf of security. It gives you nothing. There isn't a country with nuclear weapons, America, France, China, Russia, not a country that hasn't been involved in a conventional war with other countries and been defeated. We ourselves were attacked by the Argentinians over the Falklands. We got nuclear weapons. Why do they do it? Must be insane. Nuclear weapons don't actually produce security. They produce insecurity.
Now, I'm also joined by Rose Crossland from Bristol CND. Rose, can you just tell us a bit about your local group here and why you've invited Bruce down?
We're the local group for the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. We meet regularly in Bristol. We've invited Bruce as part of he's doing a month-long tour called the Scrap Trident Tour, and he's travelling, I think, for 30 days to cities up and down and towns up and down the country. The tour was launched yesterday with the big protest we held at AWE Aldermaston, and we feel we're very lucky here in Bristol to have had Bruce here for the very first day of his tour.
Okay, where is Aldermaston and why were you there?
Aldermaston is about 20 miles from Reading in the Berkshire countryside. It's got a 9-mile perimeter. It's where they design nuclear weapons, and they go and build them about 5 miles away at a place called Bergfield, which is in the same area. And so it's a high security place with a number of gates all guarded by police. And we were just going there saying we wanted to see an end to Aldermaston and the manufacture of nuclear weapons. And we got, despite the freezing weather, we got quite a lot of people there.
I mean, is there any point to protests like that? Because, I mean, this has been going on for decades, this kind of protest, without really getting anywhere. The British are still armed to the teeth with these things.
Everything changes slowly. Look at smoking. People used to think smoking was the most virile thing you could do. Nowadays, if you smoke, you can do it in the garden. You go outside. Public attitudes change, and we're about changing public attitudes.
I mean, you must find other ways rather than just standing out in the cider in the cold, looking a bit miserable. I mean, you know, isn't there any other way? Yes. Well,
never
no, but well, you're
miserable
not miserable
in my life. I spend my time writing letters to the press, going to see bishops, talking to members of parliament, apart from outdoor protests, wearing badges, all kinds of things, appearing on this wonderful programme like this one, Slurp Slurp. Any kind of way of expressing my views, I get into, and so do all the people in C&D.
I mean, do you get anywhere in lobbying? I mean, can you make any traction with the British military saying that these weapons are useless? Because, I mean, they're the ultimate weapon. A lot of military people will say, well, you know, if we get another Hitler, one of these things could make all the difference.
Make absolutely no difference. Hitler, whatever. He was already mad. Hitler had a nuclear weapon, he would have used it, whether we had one or not. Field Marshal Carver, quote, "What the bloody hell are they for?" unquote. That's Field Marshal Carver. He's talking about nuclear weapons. The senior military know perfectly well they're unusable. They're not a military instrument. And it's only the stupid politicians who are brought up in a kind of Rudyard Kipling gung-ho spirit who think because we're British we've got to make a big bang.
That's nonsense, surely, because right at the very end of the Second World War, it looked like there was going to be several more months of fighting with the Japanese. The nuclear weapon put a stop to that.
No, it didn't. On the contrary, nuclear weapons did stop the war, but that it was the only way? Not at all. The Japanese were already looking for the security of the emperor. That's all they wanted, that the emperor's position would not be hurt. And that's exactly what MacArthur gave them when the surrender took place. So nuclear weapons were not the only answer to World War II.
Are you saying that they were used unnecessarily at the end of the war? This is Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Absolutely. Absolutely unnecessarily. We were conned at the time, and now historians will show that they were not necessary at that time.
You can't just rewrite history like that, Bruce, surely.
Read a book called Racing the Enemy by a Japanese-American professor. It's perfectly true. The reason the war ended was the Soviets had moved 1 million people over to Manchuria and Japan, and the Japanese would prefer to surrender to the Americans than to the Soviet Union. That's how the war came to an end.
Okay. Now, Rose talked a little bit earlier on about your tour after Aldermaston and Trident. Now, Trident is our big nuclear defence. It sits in submarines. The idea is those submarines kind of float around the world, unseen, hidden, and means that our enemies, whoever they might be, could be struck from anywhere in the world. Now, that surely is quite a powerful diplomatic tool, and you're being a little bit reckless in saying that we shouldn't make sure that these are looked after into the future, these weapons.
Well, you've rather glossed over our enemies. Who, the IRA? Al-Qaeda? Who are going to use these things on? And anyway, you say floating around the world, what are they carrying? They're carrying missiles, and where do we get them from? We borrow them from the United States. This is no more an independent nuclear weapon.
Surely we buy them, don't we?
No, we don't borrow them. We get a different one each time. We take it back to Queens Bay or somewhere in the States, and we get another set of them, and the old ones get refurbished. They're a lease lend. Harold Wilson once said, our nuclear weapons are the Moss Bros deterrents. I don't know whether you've got Moss Bros here in Bristol, but if you want to hire a dinner jacket, you went to Moss Bros. Well, they're the Moss Bros deterrent.
Okay, so what difference does it make, though? At least they're there first to use if we want to.
Well, we're pretty mad in what situation we'll be into. And how can we possibly meet our legal obligations to negotiate abolition when we're saying we're going to have another lot for another 30 years? And what's the message to Iran? The message is, well, Britain thinks it needs nuclear weapons. Why shouldn't we have some? That's the message.
Now, some people say, and maybe you can verify this or otherwise, that our Trident nuclear deterrent is dependent on the Americans, so that if we wish to use it, we have to kind of sort of go cap in hand even now to the Americans and say, well, we would like to fire our nuclear weapons at somebody. Is that okay? And cross our fingers and hope the Americans say yes.
I think they'd have to say yes to the targeting. Once we've got the missiles and the warheads, we could fire them, but they've got to be targeted by global satellites, and that's under American control.
Oh, so we could fire them, but then we wouldn't necessarily know where they were going to land.
That's my guess, but no one will ever tell you the truth about that.
Okay, so it doesn't really sound like an independent nuclear deterrent.
It certainly isn't an independent nuclear deterrent. We are totally dependent on the United States. Even the factory at Aldermaston is American-owned now. It's three American companies working there, not British companies. So it's all an illusion that people ought to grow up and realise that we've moved on in the world and nuclear weapons are not the answer to security.
Now, I was reading recently on the newsletter for the Campaign for Accountability of American Base CAB, based up in Yorkshire, that even our RAF stations, where the Americans are, many of them don't even have any British RAF personnel on them. Even though it says RAF on the outside, they're actually completely staffed by the USSAF. I mean, are we in a situation where we really are, as Duncan Campbell said, I think it was in the 1980s, Airstrip One? You know, we are just a kind of the unsinkable aircraft carrier for the US.
Well, we were for a long time. I think we're the 51st state of the United States. Actually, that's what we are. But the Americans shifted all their stuff out of it. We don't have any American nuclear weapons here now. A few in Norfolk at a base there, but the big submarines have all gone because the range of the submarines, 6,000-7,000 miles, they don't need to be based here, and so the Americans haven't really got them. But we are American dependent, 99.5%.
How much does that reach into our politics? Because many people said that Tony Blair and before him Margaret Thatcher and others were very pro-US and really wanted to bend over backwards to do what the Americans wanted.
Yeah, well, when I was growing up at university and so on, people from America were Heritage Foundation shifting people over to the States to get brainwashing. Young graduates who were promising were being asked, invited to America, and that process has gone on. So many of our middle management in politics and media have actually already had a brainwashing in the United States for a year in Yale or a year in Harvard or something like that.
Now, the Trident seems to get renewed. Contracts get renewed every 20, 30 years or so. You know, this is something that those of us with a memory that goes back that long will probably remember this all happening probably in the 1990s, early 90s again. Now, you've estimated at CND that the total cost to the British taxpayer is going to be around about £100 billion. That's £100 billion
that's
for
right.
This latest renewal, which should last us, we hope, for 30 years. So that's £25 billion just for the missiles themselves and the submarines, and another £75 billion to keep them ticking over for the next 30 years. What might that money be spent on? I mean, that's a tremendous amount, £100 billion, if it's not on these.
They're talking about closing our local accident and emergency in North London to save about 3 million. But we're talking here of 100 billion. There's no single cut that's going on in this country that couldn't be met by the enormous Trident bill if we wanted to re-divert it. No, nothing that couldn't be saved if we reapply Trident. And yet there are other things that we haven't planned, like a decent old age pension or a proper housing programme, and all those things that we really do need in this country could be certainly advanced considerably with Trident money.
Now, another side to this, of course, is the connection with nuclear power. I mean, we just down the road here, we have got apparently two nuclear power stations about to be built by the French company EDF, because traditionally the nuclear material from the power stations was sent up to Sellafield and then it was used for weapons. I mean, surely we must have enough plutonium by now to blow the world to sky high 100 times over.
I think there are stockpiles of plutonium. I think the argument that we need power stations to produce weapons is getting quite thin. To me, the obstacle to nuclear power is that we don't know what on earth to do with the waste, which is lethal for tens of thousands of years. So we, in our supreme pride, are going to leave behind rubbish for our children's children's children, which can kill them long after we've gone. And that, I think, is absolutely, well, sinful, I think, is my word.
Now, one of the things, Bruce, I must ask you is that, you know, CND has been going for many years, probably started in the 1950s, did it? Or maybe even the late 40s?
58.
Is it really difficult to keep up the momentum? Because we're now another 50 years on from that, 50 years plus, to get people still excited about this as an issue that needs change when you've had 50 years and we've still got this massive Trident nuclear deterrent, it must be very difficult.
Yes, sometimes you think, oh my God, is it ever going to succeed? And then I read a bit of history. I look back at the slave trade. That took 40 years or something to change the attitude of the slave trade, or votes for women, took about 250 years to do that. So progress over different campaigns at different speeds. But I think the important thing is to do what you think is right, not whether you think it's going to work next year. And that's what I'm about.
Now, I can remember watching a programme, this is on the television in the 1980s, this week, called MI5's Official Secrets, with a certain woman called Kathy Massiter.
Now,
she was...
She
was... I think she was working for the Home Office, I believe.
She
I'm not
working
absolutely
at Cheltenham,
sure.
Cheltenham.
Oh, at GCHQ.
Yes.
OK, can you just tell us a bit about that story? Because it showed that the Conservative Party were actually using the Secret Services to spy on you. What were they up to?
Well, it was amazing. I was so innocent, I didn't realise what was going on. She came out and she said that they had succeeded in putting a spy in our office. And there was an old boy called Harry Newton, one of their agents, was in our office every week stuffing envelopes and trying to pick up what he could. And she said, they've got 6 box files on you, Bruce Kent, of information. And one of the dreadful allegations was that I was a pseudo-Marxist. Now, I don't even know what a real Marxist is, but to be a pseudo-Marxist, but that's what Harry Newton came up with. He died not long afterwards and went to his reward or whatever that was. But the idea that we were being looked at, but more sinisterly, I think many people wearing CND badges or CND membership weren't getting jobs in the teaching profession, in the media. They were being weeded out. We know that now because of their affiliation.
Have you got any evidence for that?
Yes, I have evidence for that. The chief constable up in Cumbria or somewhere had a party and he took people in to show them. They'd all had a bit of a drink. He said, I can show you the secretary for every CND group in the Northwest. He did them. I remember very well teachers writing to me at the time and saying they'd been asked what their affiliations were. No one would actually say, you're a CND member, so you can't have the job. You just don't get the job.
But that seems quite incredible that even, say, a primary school teacher in a little country school might not get a job because of their CND membership.
Well, I think you're too young. For the paranoia of those days, everywhere there were Soviet spies under every table. People were always, we were Marxists, we were funded by the Kremlin, we were this, that and the other. It was a very paranoid time.
So they were basically throwing this allegation at you that you were working for the Russians.
Oh, yeah. Oh, always.
And was there any kind of anything, you know, was there any kind of meat to that allegation?
None whatsoever. I was absolutely terrified once. I wrote an article for Pravda, the Soviet paper, and they paid me in rubles. And I had this cheque. I was terrified. This cheque went through my bank. I'd be denounced. I gave it to Oxfam and said, please send me a receipt for this cheque in rubles to make sure I've unloaded it. Oh, it was a very tense time like that.
But none of that anymore, no.
I don't think we bother them. I think we will bother them over Trident. That'll come up. And I hope the Labour Party will wake up to the fact that getting rid of Trident is actually going to be a vote winner. It's not a vote loser.
Well, don't hold your breath over that, because the Labour Party do seem to be sort of drifting to the centre ground. They see anything that's sort of traditionally left wing as a vote loser, don't they?
Well, they're making a mistake. In Scotland, even those people who don't want independence, 75% don't want Trident. So people can add up their sums, and £100 billion is an awful lot of money when it comes to good causes that it could be used for.
Now, do you actually have any former military people in CND? I mean, you know, you said yourself you were in the National Service. I think this is potentially one of the most interesting areas of people who have military expertise and have come to a professional decision that these weapons are useless.
Well, we have, and he's still alive, Air Marshal Alistair Mackey, who was a Vulcan bomber pilot, and he was one of a strong group of ex-services CND, but unfortunately most of those have died out. But now there's a group called Veterans for Peace that have come out of Iraq and Afghanistan, and they are not just anti-nuclear, they're talking about war generally, and they are turned off by the military activities of this country. So they're working for peace. But that's a different generation.
Bruce Kent, thanks very much. And we'll just finish by asking Rose. Rose, tell us a little bit about the local group, where you meet and how people can get in touch.
To find out when our next meeting and where our next meeting is, go to our website, which is www.bristolcnd.org.uk. We meet monthly at the Sportsman Pub near the centre at the moment. And another activity that we put quite a lot of our effort into is we run a short film competition for young people. It's open to anybody all over the country. A lot of our entrants do come from Bristol, though. And the film competition is judged by David Sproxton, one of the two co-founders of Aardman. And the films only have to be 1 or 2 minutes in length. We give £1,000 worth of prizes for this competition. And the films are all about on the subject of what nuclear disarmament means to you. This year, the brief more specifically is to tell us what you would like the world to know about nuclear weapons. Anything, any ideas that young people have that they'd like to express? We're not looking for technical proficiency. We're looking for good ideas, imaginative ideas. Go to the website for the competition. It's called the Chance of a Lifetime Competition, and that's at www.thechanceofalifetime.org.uk, and enter the competition.
Now, all that is very internet dependent. For people listening, maybe don't have any internet connections. How can they find out more?
Right, to C&D, Holloway Road, London, mark the letter Bristol C&D, and it will come straight to Bristol C&D.
And the phone number to contact Bristol C&D is 075 27 295 109. I'll say that again, 075 27 295 109, or send an email to bristolcndchair@gmail.com. that's bristolcndchair@gmail.com.
Okay, well, Bruce Kent and Rose Crossland, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you too.
Thank you.